Well, hello, gang, and welcome back to National Bugle Radio. And we have another exciting guest this hour. It's Mark Collette from Great Britain. And Mr. Collette, welcome to the show.
Hi, Patrick, and thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for being on. About a month ago, I did interview you about Brexit, and that got a very good response from the subscribers to my channel, my YouTube channel. And so I'd like to update our conversation, because I remember what you were saying a month ago was that even though the British people had voted by a very significant margin and against all sorts of dirty tricks and media propaganda, they had voted to leave the European Union, you were concerned that the establishment, that the rulers were going to do something to block this Brexit. And now, lo and behold, I heard yesterday on the radio that the High Court had said that the Parliament is going to have to vote on Brexit in order for it to go forward. Could you update us on that?
Well, I've always felt that there was going to be some form of challenge to Brexit. I didn't for one minute believe that the politicians were being honest when they put forward the idea of a referendum. In fact, I believe the referendum was going to be put forward in such a way, and the politicians believed it was going to be put forward in such a way, that the only answer was going to be Remain. And as soon as Remain won, no matter how slight the margin of victory, that would be it. It would be put to bed and never be spoken of again. But much to the establishment's horror, Leave actually won, and the country experienced Brexit, which was something that was phenomenal. And from almost the moment the news broke that the Leave camp had won, there was already discussions being made in different political circles to how the result could be overturned, or if there would be any way that elected politicians could block that result. And what you're seeing now is the end result of that. The decision was taken, was challenged in the High Court by a group of quote-unquote businessmen, and these led by an immigrant female. I think her name was Gina Miller.
Isn't she,
I believe,
an investment banker or some sort of bank?
I think she's a businesswoman.
Or a hedge fund, fund manager, something like that. Okay.
Something like that. Someone who obviously has their interests in globalism and the global economy, not any interests in national sovereignty or the rights of people to act as individual nation states. So essentially, these people have come together, they've challenged Brexit in the High Court, and their specific challenge is actually quite interesting. They've not actually challenged the validity of the referendum. They've not actually tried to have the result overturned. But what they've challenged is the right of the Prime Minister, Theresa May, to actually invoke Article 50 and begin the formal process of Brexit. And this challenge has basically stated that Parliament and the elected MPs should have to vote on the referendum and vote on whether the referendum is binding. Now, of course,
now, I remember specifically last time when we spoke asking you how the Brexit would be initiated, how Article 50 was invoked. And you said that it was purely up to the Prime Minister. And you had mentioned this is why David Cameron resigned. He had pledged to honor the result of the vote, and yet it was his responsibility and his responsibility alone to invoke Article 50, and instead he resigns and passes it on to another person, Theresa May, who had not made such a pledge. And now the High Court is saying that Parliament has to approve this invocation of Article 50.
What has happened is originally David Cameron said he would honour the public's decision. Whatever decision the public made, whether that was to remain as part of the EU or to leave the EU, he would honour that. And part of honouring that was obviously if the public voted to leave, which they did, he would trigger Article 50. Now, triggering Article 50 starts the formal process of Brexit. It starts the formal process of Britain leaving the European Union in a legal sense. And he did not do that. He resigned straight away. The first thing he did, come the morning where the result was made public, when we all woke up, we knew that the result had gone in favour of Leave. He came out of number 10 Downing Street and he resigned. And I said at the time, I said on the Dr. David Duke show when you interviewed me, that he did this so that he didn't have to trigger Article 50. So he wouldn't be the one to follow through. He never followed through on his promise. And essentially, from that point, it left it to be the next Prime Minister's duty. Now, Theresa May, who became Prime Minister, who was David Cameron's successor, she promised that she would do this, and she said it would have been triggered by the end of March next year. Now, obviously, that gave her some time to negotiate some form of agreement with Brussels, to negotiate how Brexit would take place. But in the interim, obviously, there's been this legal challenge to the High Court, and the sum total of the challenge has been that the judiciary have stated that she does not have the privilege or the right to trigger Article 50 alone, that Parliament must vote to allow Article 50 to be triggered. So it is not just the privilege of the Prime Minister, but it is something that has to be voted on by Parliament, which means that all sitting 660 MPs now have a say and must reach a majority on whether it is triggered or whether it's not triggered.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it's taken the power out of the hands of the British public who voted for Brexit and put it back into the hands of politicians, which obviously could well lead to the referendum essentially being overturned by parliamentary majority.
If the British High Court says that Parliament has to weigh in on it, and then Parliament has a lot more power, really, than the British, or the American Congress, at least constitutionally, what can be done to stop this?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer essentially is nothing. And that's the sad fact. We had this vote, and quite interesting, while you were talking there, I just pulled up the registration to vote form that went out. There was an information pack that went out before the referendum, and it was asking people to register to vote and letting people know how they could register to vote if they wanted to take part in the referendum. And I will read verbatim from the piece of paper. "This is your decision. The government will implement what you decide." Mm-hmm. Now, those two sentences are taken directly from the government information that went out before the referendum. So we actually have in writing a document mailed to every home in the UK by the government, promising the people that the government will implement whatever the people decide. So that's almost like a written contract that's been sent out, informing the people what was going to take place and promising the people that the government would implement their decision. But unfortunately, if the government chooses not to implement the will of the people, and there are already sizable blocs in Parliament, the Scottish National Party being one of them, that have already pledged that they will try to obstruct Brexit and do everything in their power to derail the people's will. So this is a major, major threat, and I always predicted something like this happening. You see, in Parliament, you can have open ballots and you can have private ballots where it's known which way MPs voted, or MPs get to vote privately, so you don't actually see who they vote for. Now, I believe if the vote is an open vote, where MPs are basically allowed to vote whichever way they want, they don't have to follow a party whip, and it is made public which side the MPs voted for, then I think that would potentially put a little bit more pressure on them to honour the will of the people. However, what really worries me is if these people are allowed a closed secret ballot on the matter, I don't think there's any chance that they will vote for Brexit to go through. Because when you look at the people in Parliament, the vast majority of MPs are part of a very small elite club that have known each other all their lives. They went to the same schools, the same colleges, the same universities. They work for the same companies, they have the same business ties, and although they maintain the charade of democracy and maintain that they really don't get on and they're fighting for different things, these people are all part of the same internationalist club, and when push comes to shove, they all want to be part of the European Union, mm-hmm. because the European Union exists to serve that internationalist club. It serves the global elite, and these people, they know where their bread's buttered, they know which side of the fence they're on, and they will vote to overturn the will of the people.
Yes, yes, and that's something I'm very concerned about regarding our presidential election this upcoming Tuesday. On my channel, I have a recent podcast, which is from an interview I did on RBN Radio on Farron Schoeff's show, The Alternative Media, and a lot of that I talk about these concerns. And before the election, I'm going to post a short podcast of me basically reading an article that I wrote about this danger. But the danger that we face here and the danger that you face with the Brexit vote is that the electoral system doesn't work the way we're told it works. It doesn't work the way we understand it to work. In your case, you have this Brexit vote, and you were told, and the people understood it to mean that if they voted to leave the European Union, they were going to leave the European Union. No ands, ifs, or buts. It was their decision to make, as that letter from the government to every household in Britain stated. And in our system, people have a certain knowledge that there's such a thing as the Electoral College, but basically they feel whoever wins the most Electoral College votes, Electoral College points, almost, on November 8th is automatically going to become the president. And that's not the case. And there's two aspects to our presidential election that are similar to what you have with the Brexit. One is that the people who are in power are conspiring to rig the system. And then the second is that because we have such old constitutions, in the United States, we have the world's oldest written constitution, and I believe Britain would be considered the world's oldest constitution, period, that there are these archaic means that people have long forgotten about, which no longer seemed relevant, but are still in existence. And I don't want to go into too much detail, because I'm going to be doing another podcast on it, but just to give one example, on Tuesday, one of the possible scenarios that's often talked about where Donald Trump wins most of the toss-up states, he loses Pennsylvania, but he wins this one electoral vote in Maine's 1st Congressional District. A very possible scenario. He would have exactly the minimum number of votes he would need to have a majority in the Electoral College. And everybody would say, oh, he won, it was a close election, he won. But what it would actually mean is that any of those 270 electors, because the electoral votes are cast by individuals who are selected, if any one of those 270 people were not to vote for him, and this happens sometimes, that the election would get thrown into the House of Representatives, and if, you know, that one defector had voted for Paul Ryan or anyone else, the House of Representatives would be able to choose that one person like Paul Ryan if they wanted to. So I'm not going to go into any more detail about that. Listeners can check either my last podcast with Farron Schoeff for some details or the next one, which will be more concise, which will be out in a day or two. So that's what it sounds like is happening in Britain. There was a vote. You were told that this was going to decide the issue. People voted understanding it would decide the issue. And now all of a sudden, the High Court is saying that under, I don't know what it's based on. It might be based on something in the Magna Carta for all I know. But based on some unknown, perhaps archaic element of the British Constitution, that no, actually, it's not the Prime Minister's prerogative, it's the Parliament, and the Parliament can, in effect, overturn this decision.
Well, that's exactly what's happened. I mean, I don't particularly understand the Electoral College system, because obviously I'm from Britain.
Nobody does. My
worry with the situation in America, or the American presidential election, stems really mainly from electoral fraud and the number of illegal aliens that might vote in the US. And what I will note about the American sort of political system at the moment is it seems that Donald Trump's got this huge support. I mean, every day on the news, and the news is obviously carries a huge left-wing bias because we know who owns the media, we know the agenda they push, yet the media can't stop reporting on these massive rallies that Donald Trump's holding. He's absolutely packing out these arenas that must hold 30, 40, 50,000 people. And sometimes these arenas are packed and there's people queuing outside wishing they could have got in. So it's literally standing room only. Yet the Hillary Clinton campaign rallies seem to be tiny in comparison. And usually there seems to be someone who always jumps up at one of the Hillary Clinton campaign rallies with a sign that says, "Bill is a rapist," or, you know, "Jail Hillary." And when I see this, it does make me worry that Hillary isn't in more of a flab. She's not panicking. She seems very cool, despite there clearly being no popular support for her. And the same can be seen in the number of Trump boards that I see sort of in pictures outside people's houses and lining the sides of the roads. Yet she doesn't seem to be bothered. It's almost as if she knows it's in the bag. It's almost as if she knows she's going to win no matter what happens. No matter what people vote for, she knows she's going to win. And we do know electoral fraud happens on an increasingly large basis. For example, taking things slightly back to Brexit, when people were voting in the referendum, there was people going to the voting booths and they were taking permanent markers with them, because in the polling booths, traditionally, there's always been pencils. And people were so concerned. This wasn't something that was just a scare story. This was the general public en masse were so concerned about electoral fraud. There were reports of people taking pens, permanent markers, down to the polling booths. And there was actually reports of women outside polling booths handing out biros and permanent markers to people going to vote, because there was such hysteria over electoral fraud. And I think that really goes to show not only the sort of scope of electoral fraud, but also the level of distrust amongst the voting population in the establishment. Like 10, 20 years ago, I don't think people would have been that distrustful of the establishment. I think people still believed it was a fair playing field. I think people believed in democracy, but I think increasingly less and less people believe in the democratic process, and more people are buying in to the notion that there is mass fraud going on and politicians are cheating the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, regarding electoral fraud, there is electoral fraud to a certain scale, and it's really difficult to know what that scale is. If Trump has a big enough landslide, then it could overwhelm the electoral fraud. But there's the potential for electoral fraud in what you mentioned, having non-citizens, even illegal aliens, voting. And I know, I have a friend who is not a U.S. citizen and who has gotten multiple letters from some very official-looking source. It looks like the state, but it's not really the state, saying, "You haven't registered to vote. Please register to vote." And she's not qualified to vote. So there's that type of thing. There's also voting twice, or voting for dead people, or voting in the name of somebody that you don't think is coming to vote. And in so many places, because you don't have to show picture ID, the only deterrent to electoral fraud is just there are laws saying you're not allowed to do it, but it's basically an honor system. There's really no enforcement. There are penalties if you get caught, but there's really no enforcement. There's no efforts to try to catch it. So you'll often hear people in the media say, "Oh, we have no examples of electoral fraud." But if you're not looking for it, if you have no mechanisms to find it, then of course you're not going to find it. If you're not looking for something, you're not likely to find it, although it does turn up. And then, of course, there's also the voting machines. And after the 2000 election, which wound up hinging on written ballots in Florida, and also these what they call the butterfly ballots, where people had a punch card and they would punch a hole next to the candidate's name, and sometimes the holes didn't get punched all the way and this and that. There was a law passed by Congress which was supposedly to remedy that situation. It's called the Help America Vote Act. But part of the Help America Vote Act included all of these provisions to make sure that disabled people, people of varying disabilities, would be able to vote. Whereas, you know, in the past, if somebody was in a wheelchair and couldn't reach the top row, some election official would go in with them and pull the levers for them. Or if somebody was blind, either a personal friend or somebody from the election commission would come in and pull the levers for them. And so only very particularly designed machines were eligible for taxpayer finance. These counties and municipalities are strapped for money, and the idea of having to buy all new machines because they're existing machines that they'd been using for years, and which for the most part had been working reasonably well, were now outlawed. They had to get new machines, and they had to get machines that conformed to all of these regulations, many of which were not designed to uphold the integrity of the vote, but were designed so that somebody with a very, very rare disability would still be able to use it. And there were machines that could have produced a paper trail that would have been verifiable, like a machine that would actually print a ballot with the name on it, and you can look at the ballot and know it's proper and then put it in the box. But those machines didn't have people in wheelchairs in mind or people who were blind in mind. And the ones that were designed to meet this this bill were ones, coincidentally, that had ownership by people with a very big stake in the political process and proprietary software, so that there's no way of confirming that the votes that you cast are going to be counted, no way of doing any kind of recount. And so there's that aspect of it, too. I don't mean to go into so much detail about it.
No, it's actually interesting listening to you, because one thing I must say about the British system is everything we do is pen on paper, and it's done with a dual counting system where when you go in, you hand over a polling card and you're checked off on a list. So there is a total of people who have been checked off on a list. Then you fill out your ballot and you put it into the sealed ballot box. And then the first thing that is done when the ballot boxes are open is the total number of votes from the ballot boxes counted and checked against the tally sheet of people who handed over their voter cards. So essentially, if those two figures don't match up, straight away you know there's something wrong. So it's actually very difficult for electoral fraud to take place, because you would literally have to replace the ballots in the ballot box with exactly the right number of ballots that had been checked off on the list, because otherwise they wouldn't tally up. So you couldn't have like 1,000 ballots ready, because if 1,200 people had voted, it wouldn't tally up. But I've always been quite interested in how a electronic voting system would work, because I really don't see how that could possibly be foolproof, because essentially, if people are just touching a screen or pressing a button, that could be altered much, much more easily than a simple pen and paper system.
Right. So in Venezuela, they use these machines that I was talking about before, where you have a touch screen and you indicate who you intend on voting for, and it simply prints out a ticket. And you can verify that the names that got printed out on the ticket are the people that you actually intend to vote for. And if there's not, there's means of remedying it. But what's really ironic... what's really ironic is all of a sudden now you've got Hillary Clinton's people talking about the possibility of these machines being hacked by the Russians. Well, I mean, if they could be hacked and altered by the Russians, they could be altered by the very companies that manufactured them and that alone have the source code for how the machines operate and cast the ballots without any hacking, because it's proprietary software that nobody else can look at.
Oh, indeed. I think one thing that raised people's awareness of electoral fraud here in Britain was just before the actual deadline for people to register to vote. You see, here we had I think the deadline was June the 7th, and everyone had to be registered to vote by June the 7th, or if you hadn't registered to vote by June the 7th, you weren't allowed to participate in the EU referendum. Mm-hmm. Yet, the evening of June the 6th, coming up to the deadline, mysteriously, the website where you could register to vote was absolutely overwhelmed literally overwhelmed by last minute registrants. People who hadn't been bothered to register for the last 2, 3, 4 weeks, but all of a sudden were desperate to register at 11 p.m. an hour before the deadline. And of course, this caused the voter registration website to crash. Mm. At which point the government said, I think it was 2 or 3 extra days of voter registration was going to be allowed. And in that time, an extra, I think nearly 500,000 people registered to vote, which is absolutely absurd. So literally 500,000 people who essentially didn't exist in electoral terms at 7 p.m. on June the 6th, all of a sudden were registered to vote after the deadline had passed. And that, to me, and to a lot of other people, really stank, and it was something that showed just how corrupt and dodgy the system could be. Because in my opinion, if you've missed the deadline for whatever reason, you shouldn't have been voting. But to suggest that 500,000 extra people wanted to vote after the deadline had passed, to me it seemed very, very odd indeed. And I'm pretty sure that all of those people who registered after the deadline were people that had been either dreamed up or drummed up by the establishment in an effort to ensure the vote went in their direction. We also have another big problem here, Patrick, which of electoral fraud from immigrant communities. You see, here we get large numbers of people settling from Islamic countries, and these people, they have huge families. You can have 5, 6, 7, 8 or even more people living in one household. And what we've actually found, what's been exposed here, you know, if people want to look this up, they can. It's very easy. Do a Google search on it. People have been registering lots and lots of voters to one single house. So you'll find houses within these immigrant communities who've got 5, 6, 7 registered voters per house, and often these voters simply don't exist. And when you've got women who are wearing the Islamic face coverings, you can't actually verify who those people are. So that woman can come to the polling booth 2, 3, 4 times with different polling cards, and no one's actually checking who she is. And these immigrant communities have been registering these voters who don't actually exist. No one checks whether these voters do exist, so then numerous votes are cast. And we also have a system where you can vote by post, so there's absolutely no way of verifying whether those people exist, because they don't have to go to a polling booth. So you might have 6, 7, 8 extra voters registered to one house. They all register for postal votes, and there you've got in just one house 5, 6, 7, 8 extra votes for one candidate, none of which are actually genuine votes, because they're just phantom people that have been invented and added to the electoral register.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Now, in the United States, in many states they have early voting, where they actually set up voting booths weeks before the election. Now, not every precinct is going to necessarily have that. I'm not sure how few and far between they might be, but you can go and vote early. And one thing that this allows for is somebody could vote one day at this polling place, one day at another polling place. And if you have voting all on one day, you can't keep going back to the same place because you'll be recognized. You have to go to different places, and it just takes time to go to different places. But when you have voting stretching over a period of weeks, you can just go to all the different places. You have a lot more time to do this. So that's one problem. One other, you mentioned your immigrant community. I'm going to mention the black community, because we have many precincts which are basically entirely black, and where typically voter turnout's not very high, but it is exclusively Democratic. And I've looked at the vote for elections on a precinct-by-precinct basis in cities. And if you look at the black precincts, you'll often find 100% of the vote going for Democrats. Now, what this allows for is if you're going to have people who don't really vote, but you're going to have another person come and vote in his place, or, you know, you're going to use the voter registration of people who are deceased or whatever, you get much more leverage out of doing this in a black community, especially because the black community typically has very low turnout. So there's a lot of registered voters who never turn out anyway. You can use their names. Plus, if it's 100% for Hillary, nobody's going to ask questions because they vote automatically for Hillary anyway. If you wanted to do the same type of voter fraud in the suburbs, and all of a sudden a area that is roughly 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans, if all of a sudden it's got an 75-25 split, that's going to raise a red flag because it would be such a departure from the norm. Whereas you can really leverage these black precincts that have traditionally very low turnout, probably are going to have low turnout now, but that means there are all of these people on the rolls who aren't voting, but other people can vote for them and they can vote 100% Democrat and it won't raise a red flag. That's another point. But the point I was making about the Electoral College is that's rigging the system after the vote, just as this decision by the High Court to send the Brexit referendum now to Parliament is rigging the system after the vote.
I think the one thing the establishment does want to watch out for, and I think they're acutely aware of this, that especially in the case of Brexit, which has been, you know, as I said earlier, it was something that the government, you know, sent out an actual mail out promising to honour. I think when the establishment does decide to go back on these votes or does decide to tamper with the will of the people, they are actually pushing more and more people into a revolutionary mindset. You see, the charade of democracy is only upheld when people actually believe that they can change the political landscape through electoral change. As soon as you actually tell people implicitly that, no, it doesn't matter who you vote for or which party you vote for or how you vote in a popular referendum, makes no difference. We will do what we want anyway. Then the charade of democracy is completely destroyed. That's it, it's gone. And once you leave people with the implicit knowledge that it doesn't matter how they vote, nothing will ever change, you then turn people from believers in democracy. You turn people from quiet individuals who will carry on in their daily lives and they will go to the polling station and they will engage in politics despite what we may think of that. You turn those people into revolutionaries, and I personally think the establishment is playing a very dangerous game. Mm-hmm. And if they continue to play this game and more people do see through the charade of democracy, it will start to lead to a dangerous polarization in society that will lead down a road of violence. And the establishment is aware that more and more people are distrustful of politicians and more people actively hate politicians. The number of people now being arrested in this country, the number of news stories about death threats towards politicians, you know, violent language towards politicians, you know, quote unquote hate speech on Twitter and Facebook towards politicians, you hear about it more and more every day, and the media loves reporting on it, and it's only growing. Well, that's only going to be fueled more and more if the establishment pull the veil off democracy and say, yeah, democracy, it is just a lie. We'll do what we want anyway. We know best. We rule over you, and you're going to do what we say. And if the establishment say that in such an implicit way as they are doing now with Brexit, it will fuel a revolutionary mindset.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had been very active for the Leave campaign. So if the Parliament winds up overturning the will of the people as expressed in the Brexit vote, what do people in your movement do?
That's a very good question, actually. And I think the most important thing to do is to go to the people and tell the people, this is why democracy is a charade. These people, they all work together. The illusion of choice is just that, an illusion. Whether you vote Conservative, whether you vote Labour, it makes no difference. These people sit together in Parliament. They are not foes, but they are friends. They are part of the same club, and this club has taken away your freedom of choice. This club has taken away your right to vote. You now are essentially not electing representatives to Parliament. You are electing people to govern over you and to control your life. People who no longer represent what you want, no longer speak for you, but people who tell you how you have to live your life and tell you what you should and shouldn't do. And when you take that message to people, and when you put it in those quite simple terms, I think that will wake a lot of people up. Because we've been saying that for years, Nationalists all over the Western world have been saying those things for years. But unfortunately, people have had a hard time buying into that. People haven't readily accepted, because people don't like to accept that they don't have a choice. People don't like to feel powerless. They don't like to feel that their vote doesn't count. So people have been slow to accept those facts. But I think when presented with our message, backed up with the hard facts and the case of Brexit, more and more people will become distrustful of the system. And more people that become distrustful of the system, the quicker the system will crumble. So I think that's what people have to do. We have to organise. We have to organise on a community basis. We have to print leaflets. We have to go door to door. We have to speak at community events. And we have to take this message to the public and double down on what we've been saying for years, that these politicians do not offer a viable choice for our people. There is no choice. Whether you vote Conservative or Labour, whether you vote Republican or Democrat, essentially, with a few exceptions, obviously Donald Trump being the notable exception, you are essentially voting for two sides of the same coin. You're just voting for two different people who happen to be part of the same club and ultimately will make choices that lead Western civilization to the same bloody end.
Now, Brexit is having Britain, the United Kingdom, leave the European Union. And I think probably yourself, I would assume yourself and many other people, really don't see Brexit as an end. It's really a means to an end. It's not as if the European Union itself is the problem, but that membership in the European Union facilitates a lot of the problems that you have. And leaving the European Union might make it easier to overcome these fundamental problems, like having massive immigration, replacement level immigration, where the British people, the traditional British people, the people whose ancestors lived for centuries or millennia on the British Isles, are being replaced very rapidly by people from completely other regions of the earth. I mean, that seems to be probably the most important issue that the Brexit supporters really care about, rather than whether or not there's, you're in a free trade zone or things like that. Am I mistaken?
No, you're completely correct. And actually, many people who voted for Brexit, many people who voted to leave the EU in the EU referendum, were using the EU referendum as a referendum on immigration and as a platform to protest against current immigration policies. And obviously the EU, with its open border system, has played a huge role in allowing Britain to be swamped by immigrants. Now, the issue here with the EU, it is quite interesting, because there is another dynamic to all this. The EU essentially has sort of legal precedent over British law. As a member state of the EU, the EU can overrule British law. And I think politicians in Britain have actually used the EU as quite a convenient get out of jail free card. Every time something has happened in Britain that British politicians may well have voted for, British politicians have always played the card that, oh, well, this is European law. This isn't us doing this to you. It's Europe. It's Europe. We would have sent these people home. We wouldn't have allowed these foreign criminals to stay here. But Europe forces us to. So keep voting for us, because we're really on your side. But ultimately, it's Europe that makes us do these terrible things, and it's Europe that's eroded your sovereignty, and it's Europe who has forced us to take all these immigrants masquerading as hard-done-to refugees. It's all Europe's fault. And I think the interesting thing about Brexit is, as you say, Brexit wasn't an end in itself, but it was the beginning of something new. Because once that get-out-of-jail-free card had been taken away from British politicians, once they could no longer say, well, it's not us doing this to you, it's Europe, it's the European law, it's the European Court of Human Rights. And when I say European Court of Human Rights, it's not really about human rights at all. The European Court of Human Rights is more about giving rights to people who are criminals. I think, ultimately, Brexit would, had Britain left Europe, firmly shone the light back on British politicians. They could no longer have laid the blame on Europe or on faceless bureaucrats within the European system. It would have been on their heads. When immigration hadn't slowed down, because believe me, Patrick, whether we're in the EU, or whether we're a sovereign nation, all of the mainstream politicians are ultimately committed to mass immigration. Mm-hmm. Mass immigration would have gone on with or without the European Union. And many of these people who claim to be against European immigration seem to be even more suicidally intent on non-European immigration. And believe me, if I've got to live next to an immigrant family, I would much rather live next to a family of Poles than I would live next to a family of Somalians. Mm-hmm. Now, these politicians, once they've lost that get-out-of-jail-free card, once they can't blame European law or the European Court of Human Rights any longer, the spotlight would have been shone directly on them as to why the numbers of immigrants coming into Britain hadn't decreased. So, as you rightly said, I never saw Brexit as an end, but I saw it as the beginning of the next stage of our political struggle here in Britain.
Mm-hmm. Now, regarding the immigration, and you noted while the British politicians have a get-out-of-jail-free card in that they can talk about immigration as being determined by the EU, and so there's nothing they can do about it, yet at the same time, those same British politicians are really pro-immigration. You know, David Duke and Kevin MacDonald and many others have looked at the immigration issue, especially in the United States, but also in other countries, in Europe and Australia, and you see this leading Jewish role in it. And I think one of the reasons why you have the international globalists, which is practically another way of just saying international Jewish power, and why they support the EU, or why they'll support the federal American government over states, is that they have small numbers, and so it's easier for them to dominate regions the more centralized power is over a large area. Now, the thing about Britain or France in particular, they have large Jewish populations themselves. You know, a country like Spain or Italy is probably undergoing such immigration pressure. It might be more from their membership in the EU. They probably don't have as strong Jewish factions that dominate their media and politics the same way. For instance, I mean, Italy's media is dominated by Berlusconi, who might be relatively Zionist, but he's not Jewish, whereas in America, our media is completely dominated by Jewish owners. So Britain could leave the EU. It might not create the same kind of change in policy that, say, Austria or Spain or Italy or maybe Hungary leaving the EU, where it would turn these policies back over to nationalist politicians who are not under a control of Jewish donors and Jewish media moguls. So even if Brexit goes through and Britain leaves the EU, you still think that it would be a lot of work left to be done in order to slow down or reverse some of these losses to immigration?
Oh, definitely. And one of my great worries actually about Brexit, and specifically, I said this to quite a few people before the vote actually was held, was one of my worries was that if Brexit went through, if we were successful with a leave vote at the European referendum, I was worried that many people would think that was it. You know, that's it. The battle's won.
And I've heard people who express those worries.
Yeah, and that worries me because, you see, we don't have anything like a nationalist government. The Conservative Party here in Britain make patriotic noises from time to time, but they're really just as globalist and multiculturalist as the Labour Party. The only thing is, they don't do it in such an overt way. I kind of see politics not as a fixed spectrum, but always as something that's fluid, moving in one direction or the other. You either move towards multiculturalism and ultimately white genocide, or you move towards sovereign, healthy white nations which have got a homogenous makeup. Now, if you're moving towards multiculturalism, you're moving in that direction at a particular speed, almost like you're in a car driving towards the end of the cliff. Mm-hmm. And my opinion on the Conservative Party and the Labour Party is that they're both sat in the car. They're both driving the car towards the edge of the cliff, and the British population's in the back seat, you know, waiting for their impending doom. Now, if you vote Conservative, the car moves slightly slower towards the edge of the cliff. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you vote Labour, it moves more quickly towards its impending doom. So essentially, it doesn't really matter who you vote for. You're going over the edge of the cliff. It's just how long it takes you to get there. And that really is the situation in Britain. Both parties are committed to multiculturalism, mm-hmm. to globalism. They're both committed essentially to end of Britain as a sovereign white nation. So my worry with Brexit, just to go back to your initial question, is that ultimately people who saw that as the end of the political struggle, as the end game, they're greatly mistaken. Because even if Theresa May does somehow trigger Article 50, or if Parliament does vote by a majority for Article 50 to be triggered, and Brexit does go through, not that much is going to change. Mm-hmm. The same things will continue to happen. Immigration will continue at the same rate. We will carry on seeing policies of globalism, of British jobs going abroad, of immigrant workers coming here. And quite crucially, no matter what does happen with Brexit, both of the main parties in Britain have already said that even if Brexit goes through, they're both still committed to Britain remaining part of the single European market so we can trade freely with Europe. But part of the deal of staying in the European single market is that you still have to allow European nationals full freedom of movement into Britain. So Brexit won't actually make any difference on the levels of third world immigration or the levels of European immigration into Britain.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to pick up your analogy of the car driving towards the cliff, while the Tories might drive the car a little more slowly, they might also drive it a little more smoothly, which would prevent the people from being as alarmed. That's one of the problems.
I really like that. That's very well put. And that's something that's true. People do vote conservative because they do give the people a slightly smoother ride. People do believe that they are an answer to the Labour Party. They do believe in the political discourse between the two main parties, which is, of course, all just a sham.
So what you're saying is, even if Article 50 is triggered, still, without having a nationalist movement that is explicitly committed to changing immigration laws and changing border control laws and other relevant laws, social welfare policies, without that, you're still heading off the cliff.
We are, because ultimately you don't just need a party now that's committed to stopping further immigration. You need a party that's willing to tackle the problems that certain immigrant communities have created here in Britain. The fact is, we in Britain have experienced mass immigration from the Middle East and from Islamic states, and I'm not sure what the size of the Muslim population in America is, but here in Britain it's quite sizable. Mm-hmm. And when you have large immigrant communities from Islamic states settling in a nation, those people do cause incredible tension with the native population. And that's something that, unless you have a strong nationalist party in government, unless you have a party that's willing to talk about things such as race, ethnicity, and religion, you can never tackle that problem. Because if you can't even discuss the problem, you're never going to get anywhere close to solving it. And the issue here in Britain is, these Islamic communities have preyed upon the native people. They've sexually abused and groomed thousands of young British girls in single towns. So we're not talking about thousands of girls being abused across the nation. We're talking about tiny northern towns that have had thousands of girls sexually abused just in that one town.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, one thing that's a very difficult to talk about, but sooner or later really has to be talked about, is in America, in Britain, in Australia, in other Canada, we have these huge minority populations which aren't assimilating and may not be desirable for assimilation. At some point, there needs to be a discussion of it. It might be premature for that discussion at this point. But in the United States, we had a lot of European immigration in the 1800s. And my Irish immigrant ancestors didn't necessarily fit in that well. It took some generations. Eventually, most Irish Americans aren't necessarily even aware of their Irish background. They think of themselves as nothing more than Americans or nothing more than whites. But it took a long time. It may be that, you know, there are people who come from Mexico and have been here for 40 years and hardly speak English. There are now big groups of Somalis and others who we don't necessarily want to have assimilated. They don't want to adopt Christianity. They want to cling to Islam. And do we really want to have huge communities? But it's as if our elite is saying, well, Muslims are underrepresented in America. We need more. And Hillary has this plan to have more. What I'm trying to get at is at some point, and it's probably not yet, but at some point there really needs to be a discussion about regarding the immigrant communities, what's possible? How much do we just have to accept as water under the bridge because they came legally and they're established and they might not destroy the society through their assimilation? There's others who are much more problematic. So if we get the upper hand where we're able to start setting policy, we have to start thinking about, you know, how much do we accept? What's possible? It's not as if you can deport everybody that immigrated to our countries in the past few decades, but it's not as if you have to accept everybody that's here also. So I'm just kind of throwing that out. I don't know if it's really premature to start talking about it or not, but I'm throwing it out there.
No, it's a good question. Firstly, I've got to say the first thing we've got to do is we've got to smash the lie that Western nations are by their nature multicultural or multiracial nations. They're not. These are our nations. These belong to the European people, to the indigenous European people. And that's the first thing we need to come out and say, and we need to stay firm on, because I'm absolutely sick of hearing that somehow Britain's already always been a multicultural country, and it was built off the back of multiculturalism, because it wasn't. It was built off the blood, sweat and tears of the native people, of Europeans. Now, when we come to the question, which is quite a thorny issue, of things like repatriation and who can stay or who would have to go, I think you'd have to look at the situation based on how similar the people are to us. For example, if you've got a number of Polish families who are Christian, who have learned English, who have adopted a way of life that is significantly similar to that of the British people, and who are fitting in, and who can be easily assimilated in a couple of generations. For example, if a Polish family has lived here for 5-6 years, had children here, and the children speak English as a first language, and those children go on to have children who are brought up through our schooling system, and are part of our communities, and go to the same churches, and do the same pastimes, essentially, those people can become British and they can assimilate very quickly. But then there are other groups within our society, like the large numbers of people from Islamic states, who I don't believe will ever assimilate. They don't want to assimilate, and ultimately their culture is moving in the opposite direction to ours. They're not going to fit in, and they never will fit in. And if they stay here, they have such high birth rates, ultimately, they will end up importing their culture to the exclusion of ours. They will turn areas into mini Islamic states. And you can see that all over Britain. It was just in the news the other day that there's an area in part of a northern mill town called Dewsbury. And this area is called Savilltown. Now, the media was gleefully reporting that in Savilltown there's a population of just over 4,000 people. And out of those 4,000 people, there's just 43 on the census who identify as white British. Mm. The rest are all Muslims. And that's simply not something that I'm comfortable with. I don't want to see entire areas, towns or cities be taken over by these people. I've got a certain degree of respect for these people. Don't think I'm putting them down. I respect the fact that they want to retain their own culture and heritage, and that they want to bring up their children with their own religion, with their own language and their own ways of life. But the fact is, if they want to bring up their children with those ways, and if they want to live by those ways, they shouldn't be here living in Britain, because there's plenty of places all over the world where those people can live under Islamic law. Mm-hmm. They can live under Sharia law. They can marry 6 or 7 women. They can teach their children their religion, their ways, their languages. And that's fine, because that's the place to do that. But unfortunately, Britain isn't the place to do that. Britain is the place to speak English, to basically follow British tradition, British culture, and to be part of our society and our culture. So yes, there will be cases where people can assimilate, but there'll also be cases where people don't want to assimilate and shouldn't be forced to do so. And it would be undesirable both for us and for them to assimilate. But in those cases, those people have to go to places in the world where they can live under the law they want to live under.
Right. And I think one thing we can all agree on is we've got to stop with these Zionist wars in the Middle East, in the Islamic world, which I'm sure part of the motivation for them is to create chaos whereby people are going to feel that they need to flee or give them the pretext to flee and come to Europe or America or Canada or Australia. You know, we had in the 1990s a lot of Chinese students come to American universities, and they would come and never go back. But as the Chinese economy developed and China became a place where they could be Chinese and make money like Chinese and live like Chinese, in the 2000s, you started seeing them come over, they'd get their education, they might save up a bit of money, and then go back to China and build their future in China. And if we stop messing around in the Middle East, which we know is it's not in our national interest, just let these countries develop the way they want to develop, there's going to be a lot less motivation for them to leave and come to our countries. And in fact, a lot of the people who are in our countries are going to see good opportunities for them where they can go and be amongst their own culture.
I completely agree with you. The wars in the Middle East have served two purposes, really, and both of these purposes please the Zionists immensely. On one hand, the wars in the Middle East have completely destabilized strong sovereign Islamic nations. So Iraq, it was once a sovereign nation. Saddam Hussein, he might have treated some people quite brutally. He might have been unfair to certain groups, but it was still a relatively secular nation that was peaceful and law and order did reign. Mm-hmm. Now, for the state of Israel, that isn't something they want. They do not want strong Arab states. They are fearful of strong Arab states. So the West goes in and it smashes Iraq. It destroys it. Then the West goes in and it funds groups in Syria. So another secular state which is ordered, peaceful, and relatively strong is smashed. The West smashed Libya in the same way. And every time the West does this, it serves Israel, because Israel doesn't want strong Arab states, because they believe that strong Arab states pose a threat to the future of Israel. So that's one reason for the Zionists to smile. And the second reason the Zionists are smiling is because every time the West destabilizes one of these sovereign states, the people who are left living in abject poverty, the people who are left without homes, without clean running water, who are left without food and shelter, where do they come? They flood into the West en masse, and with them they bring poverty, they bring crime, they bring terrorism, they take Western benefits, they abuse our system, and then they breed at an incredible rate, which puts our services under pressure and sees white people become an even smaller minority in their own nations. Mm. And obviously, that pleases the Zionists. So these wars in the Middle East are a huge double-edged sword, which cuts both Arab states and cuts Arab people, and also cuts European states and cuts the European people, both of which seem to please Zionists immensely.
I think you're so right. Well, Mark Collette, thank you so much for coming on National Bugle Radio, and I hope that you'll come back again.
Oh, I hope so too, and thank you for having me, Patrick, and I look forward to coming on again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And tune back soon for another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.